Welcome to the third episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a new podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These are premier and renowned meetings that educate community-based oncologists and healthcare professionals on novel treatment approaches for patients with cancer. The summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in therapeutic areas such as breast cancer, lung cancer, genitourinary cancer, hematology, or ovarian cancer. In Onc Live On Air, you can expect to hear interviews with academic oncologists on the thought-provoking presentations they give at these meetings. The topics vary from systemic therapies, surgery, radiation therapy, to emerging therapeutic approaches in a particular disease. That brings us to today's episode. On August 2nd, we headed out to Denver, Colorado for a State of the Science Summit on Advanced Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. The conference spans screening, molecular profiling, early stage advances, treatment for oncogenic-driven advanced disease, and immunotherapy. We sat down with our co-chairs of the meeting, Dr. Robert M. Jotti of Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers and Dr. D. Ross Kamage of the University of Colorado, Denver. Here's what they had to say about advances in standard of care and the lung cancer paradigm. Hi, Dr. Jotti. Thank you for sitting down with us today to talk about screening and multidisciplinary management. What are some updates in this area?
So what I spoke about this evening was primarily lung cancer screening and the concept of lung cancer screening, as well as the concept of instituting lung cancer care through a multidisciplinary approach. And in the initial portion of the presentation, we talked a little bit about the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial. And again, a large trial looking at over 53,000 patients where we screened patients for lung cancer and then followed them for lung cancer specific outcomes based on screening them with a low dose spiral CT versus a chest X-ray. And what we found was that the incidence of lung cancer detection was much greater with the low dose CT scan. And equally important was the outcomes of those patients. So if those patients had their lung cancers identified, they typically tended to be earlier stage lung cancers, much more amenable to surgical resection, and therefore much higher outcomes in terms of overall survival. And so several years ago, it became a new standard of care to actually screen patients with these screening CT scans if they met the appropriate criteria based on their age, their smoking history, so what we kind of constitute as their risk factors. And so if we institute that screening, what you could find is that as you follow those patients, you could cure a lot more patients of their early stage lung cancers than you could if they presented at later stages. So if we institute those spiral CT scans as part of our screening process, primarily in first events with patients, so primary care providers, if they're screening their patients for lung cancer, you can save a lot of people's lives by identifying their lung cancers at an earlier stage. And what that comes out to be is about 20% improvement in overall survival at 5 years. And so if we institute this and you look at the number of lung cancer patients that are diagnosed, and unfortunately a very high percentage of the diagnoses correlates with the number of patients that actually die from their disease, so disease-specific survival and death with regards to lung cancer, those patients that if we instituted everybody that reached those high-risk criteria, we would save a tremendous number of lives in the United States alone, let alone globally. But specifically, the statistics I talked about were more here in the United States. And while there's a little bit of mathematics involved in the number that I came up with, the equivalence of over 40,000 lives could be saved per year just by instituting screening and getting those patients to the operating room rather than getting them to the IV chemotherapy chair.
Why is there such a low screening rate?
The reason why there's such a low rate of screening, as presented in the ASCO data that I alluded to in the talk and presented in the talk, There's certainly multiple factors, but I think the primary reason is that the topic just isn't being brought up. You know, I see it in my office all the time that many primary care providers are expected to wear so many different hats. They have to take care of so many different problems. And lung cancer screening is just yet another one of those things on the list of things that have to be mentioned in a relatively brief office visit. And so you have to prioritize what's the immediate risk to this patient here in the office. And so it's sometimes hard for us to focus on those risks that are down the road. If it were to become a topic that's discussed, likened to cholesterol or hypertension, and we talked to every patient about their smoking history, and gosh, you're still smoking, you should really be screened for lung cancer, that we institute that, and those percentages of screenings will go up tremendously. And then if we can increase on that, then certainly the identification of those early lung cancers.
How does shared decision-making impact the likelihood of screening?
Well, it's that is something that's discussed with the patient. The reason for the CT scan and the incidence of detection, which essentially falls into a category of what we call false positive and false negative rates. And so we have criteria that we utilize in, for example, say someone comes in and they've got a solitary pulmonary nodule that's identified and it's an early lung cancer. There's specific criteria that we follow called the Fleischner criteria, and those Fleischner criteria have recently been updated. And the whole purpose of those criteria are to minimize unnecessary invasive procedures and maximize the detection rate. And so we follow those criteria, and radiologists will allude to those criteria oftentimes in their radiology reports in terms of how we follow those patients, who needs to be worked up and who needs to be biopsied. So it's a shared decision-making process that takes care between that takes place between the provider and the patient, so that the patients understand what all of those things are. But again, you can see how just how we've been talking about this already. You've got a patient that's got 15 minutes to disclose all their problems and address all those problems. This is taking a couple of minutes to discuss it already, and it's for a risk that may not ever materialize, but for those patients where it does, it could be life-saving.
Have any trials addressed which areas of the United States have better screening rates and what those programs look like?
So that abstract that I presented did break down the United States into four geographic areas, and the Northeast had a higher rate of screening, but that rate, even though it was almost 4%, is still only at 4%. And then the lowest rate was out here in the West, and so that's why I was pushing everybody to get out there and screen, because we have the lowest rate here of only 1%. So clearly a tremendous amount of opportunity to offer patients more screening.
Moving into multidisciplinary management, who were those other key players?
So in terms of multidisciplinary management of patients with lung cancer, there's a whole host of physicians that take place in patients' care. So the medical oncologist like myself, but you also have physicians like surgeons, radiologists, pathologists, radiation oncologists. Even, you could start take it out much further and start to include other avenue or other disciplines like social workers and financial counselors and all sorts of people, that physical therapists, occupational therapists, nutritionists, all these people that can help play a role in the management of these patients and make their experience and potentially their quality of life and maybe even their overall survival improve. So the data that I presented talked about all those different things in terms of trying to determine whether if someone actually is followed or presented in a multidisciplinary clinic or tumor board, are their outcomes any different than someone who sees a physician who tells them which direction to go? And so the data suggests that there are certainly some advantages of going through a multidisciplinary clinic. But there's also some caveats to that. And those caveats are, just because you get presented doesn't mean that someone's following up on how that patient should be managed. So for example, you really need to have an administrator or somebody that's taken the responsibility of John Q. Public. If our recommendation is A, B, and C, that someone's making sure that that patient does indeed get recommended A, B, and C, and that patient follows through on A, B, and C. And then you know that that multidisciplinary approach, which incorporates those recommendations are actually followed through, and therefore you might start seeing those improvements in that in the outcome, patient outcome data.
What is the frequency of screening to date?
So that is a black box or a gray box. So nobody really knows exactly what to recommend in terms of the frequency of screening. So when someone institutes a screening program, you'll have a lot of patients that come in all at once. Well, then you have those patients that their CAT scan today was negative, but 2 years from now, it might turn positive. And that might be that one patient that you've got to capture to operate on early so that they have that improvement in overall survival despite their lung cancer diagnosis. The problem is you have all those patients come in on day one, they all get their screen, and then everyone says, okay, I'm fine, so I don't have to screen myself anymore. And so you lose a lot of those patients in that screening process that should continue down the road. We don't have any specific recommendations as to how often someone should get a CAT scan. So they get a CAT scan, you know, once a year, every 2 years, every 3 years, every 5 years, etc. If someone has an abnormality identified, for example, a solitary pulmonary nodule, that's where those Fleischner criteria really come into play so that we capture those patients that are potentially going to develop a lung cancer versus those that have benign etiologies.
What are the key takeaways from your presentation?
I think the key takeaway is that we need to be doing a much better job of screening our lung cancer patients. I shouldn't say lung cancer patients, I should say screening our smokers and our high-risk patients so that we can identify those lung cancer patients. So those patients don't ever have to even have the topic of chemotherapy or immunotherapy or all the other topics that we're going to be presenting in our program today. So we really need to do a better job of screening. And there's a lot of barriers in that, as we've already mentioned, but the key piece is how poorly we are doing as a medical group in terms of screening those high-risk patients for lung cancer. And the other piece is that as far as a multidisciplinary approach to lung cancer, the data that's out there, while it's not the most substantial data out there to push us one way or the other, certainly has a strong leaning towards improved outcomes, improved use of modalities of therapy such as radiation therapy and implementation of chemotherapy. And if we treat patients as a team as opposed to individuals, those patients' outcomes are likely to be much better.
Thank you, Dr. Jotty, for such a great interview. Next, we have Dr. Kamage, who discussed the use of personalized therapy in lung cancer with a focus on immunotherapy. Welcome, Dr. Kamage. Can you share the main points of your presentation?
The title of my presentation was Immunotherapy Panacea or Personalizable Therapy. And that's because I think we're entering a renaissance in terms of immunotherapy for non-small cell lung cancer, not necessarily just because, you know, we have these new drugs, but we have a better understanding that they don't work in everybody and how we should use them. So the whole battleground has moved to the first line. So we have the idea that by enriching for PD-L1, you can give pembrolizumab monotherapy. That was the KEYNOTE-024 study. And their enrichment meant a tumor proportion score of 50% or greater, which is about 30% of lung cancer across all histologies. And then we had the KEYNOTE-189, which shook that up a little bit because that was about combining, at least in the non-squamous population, platinum pemetrexed plus or minus pembrolizumab. And you could see that regardless of PD-L1 level, you seem to get benefit, not equal benefit, but you seem to get benefit from the addition of the pembrolizumab. And so now suddenly everybody, at least in non-squamous, has a chemo-immuno option. And if you have the high tumor proportion score, you actually have both a chemo-immuno option and an immunotherapy monotherapy option. Now, one of the research questions is, in that high TPS group, which is the right one? You know, do they need the chemo? Do they need the you know, in the chemo-immuno combination or just immunotherapy alone? And that's actually going to be answered in a cooperative group study called Insignia, and that will be running in the next few years. The other burning research questions are, well, in KEYNOTE-024, you know, they had enriched to, you know, just 30% of the population. to say this is the ones that you could give pembrolizumab monotherapy to. Was that too high a bar, or could there be benefit given that we know that occasionally you can get responders at lower tumor proportion score? Is there a larger group that maybe you could have an immunotherapy option alone? And that was the KEYNOTE-042 study, which was essentially the like 024, but it allowed people with 1% or greater. To be honest, the headline was, oh, look, the overall survival hazard ratio is better. But I think that is misleading, because when you show greater than or equal to 1%, you're still including those people with high tumor proportion scores. And when you take those out and you look in just the 1 to 49%, the overall survival hazard ratio is not actually statistically significant. And I think, again, we're seeing that most of the benefit is being driven by that high TPS. So for me, if you don't have the high TPS, monotherapy with pembrolizumab, it shouldn't really be an option unless you're just so unfit for anything else. And you should probably have the chemo immuno. The other area that we're starting to see is, you know, can squamous join the party? We already know if you have the high TPS in squamous, you've got pembro as a monotherapy option. But what about chemo immuno with squamous? Well, we saw two studies at ASCO, one with atezolizumab, one with pembrolizumab, adding into a platinum paclitaxel or platinum nab-paclitaxel arm, both suggesting benefits in terms of PFS and overall survival. And I think a lot of people are expecting that we're going to have a chemo-immuno option for squamous fairly soon.
Moving forward, will physicians need to evaluate biomarkers in combination versus PD-L1 or tumor mutational burden alone?
In terms of biomarkers for immunotherapy, this is a work in progress. I think, you know, in the first line setting, when you're combining with chemotherapy, you could say, oh, it's a done deal, but there are almost certainly people who are not deriving benefit. It's hard to imagine pharma would be very interested in identifying a smaller market size, but academics may do that. Yeah, if you had to say, what are the biomarkers you want to need? The assumptions that we make for immunotherapy are so much more exaggerated than we do for targeted therapy. Targeted therapy, you know, if I find the mutation, I can be very confident that's going to turn into an abnormal protein. I can be very confident that's going to be driving the cell and be sensitive to the tyrosine kinase inhibitor. For immunotherapy, the assumptions that I make are much higher risk. I'm assuming if I have a high tumor mutation burden, that means I've got more neoantigens. I'm assuming that those are going to be presented on that patient's MHC. I'm assuming that they will be presented in a permissive immune environment and that the relevant checkpoints I'm going to use are involved. Each one of those assumptions is high risk, and therefore the predictive benefit of any of these biomarkers is much less than, for example, an EGFR mutation or ALK. So how do we get around that? Well, we have to combine biomarkers at multiple steps in that process to reduce the assumptive risks that we're making. So tumor mutation burden doesn't guarantee benefit. It's just enriching stuff, if you like, at the top end of the immune cascade. PD-L1 expression is at the bottom end, at least for PD-1 monotherapy. And then we're going to get biomarkers along the way. Maybe we'll get better bioinformatics. Are the mutations changing the amino acid sequence? Are they going to be presented on that patient's MHC? Are all mutations equally immunogenic? No, we know that insertions are very immunogenic, point mutations less so. Do we have other biomarkers for what's going on in that tumor microenvironment? And I think multiple biomarkers will be a way of enriching for benefit. And how will we use them? I don't know if we'll ever get to something that says you have 100% chance of responding to immunotherapy. Maybe we'll get to some markers that says you have a 0% chance or close to that, or with the, in some countries, the health economics will say this is effectively zero. You know, the cost benefit doesn't justify it. But maybe what we're going to use these for is, just like we saw in the first line studies, a means of enriching for the population that will benefit for any kind of immunotherapy. And we're going to see them in combination studies going forward. So in the IO experienced population, where it's like, what do we do next? It's like, my latest, you know, immuno-oncology agent plus PD-1, PD-L1 as the backbone. We're going to see methods, for example, enriching for tumor mutation burden, enriching for other things. Not to say we've identified the group it works in, but to say we've got rid of some of the group that are less likely to benefit, and now our response rate will appear to go up.
Let's talk about clinical trials. What data are you looking forward to reading out over the next few years?
So I think I think in terms of the exciting clinical trials, I mean, there's a whole bunch out there. My worry is that a whole bunch of immune combination studies are all going to be wrong. Well, not wrong, sorry, let me rephrase that. Are going to not give us a definitive result because they're not enriching for the right population. They're just randomly guessing. I think in terms of the immunotherapy research opportunities, I think the Insignia trial is a cooperative group trial, which is really interesting. You know, Pembro versus chemo Pembro in the high TPS is an interesting question. I think asking questions about the duration of immunotherapy in people who are benefiting is an interesting question, probably not going to be addressed by pharma. I think honing in on biomarkers, for example, for hyperprogression, excessive toxicity, I think so we might whittle away at the group that we feel comfortable giving these drugs to will be useful. In the targeted therapy setting, I think there's a whole bunch of studies that are going to be interesting. In my own personal field, the first-line ALK inhibitors, I think, are going to be really interesting to read out. We have alectinib. That's kind of grabbed hold of the first-line setting. But we have a number of other drugs which have better outcomes post-crizotinib in that setting. And whether they will transition that ranking in the second-line setting to being equally ranked in the first line setting. So will brigatinib turn out to be a better drug? Will lorlatinib turn out to be a better drug? The one good thing is these drugs are working so well, it's taking years for the data to mature, which is great for the patients, frustrating for the scientists, but we're just going to have to be patient to get that real result.
As co-chair of this State of the Science Summit, what were some of the most important questions that you mediated on the Q&A panel discussion?
We had a wonderful panel because, at least in the Metro Denver area, we had representation from at least three of our community partners, Rocky Mountain Cancer Center, Sarah Cannon Research Institute, and Kaiser Permanente. We're all working on the challenge of looking after lung cancer patients together. And it was really interesting to just sort of see how these very smart people are both managing things the same. So a lot of people are very comfortable waiting for molecular results back. They're not trying to treat everybody the same. Also recognizing the challenges that they're facing in terms of, well, you know, do I have to send off a big panel of tests for something that might just turn up in a study? I think we're almost at the tipping point now where, you know, if you have to test for about four different analytes, you're almost at the point where it's as cheap to do a large panel of things. And so particularly for Kaiser, which is quite cost conscious, that's where they're almost at the tipping point. In terms of questions that were answered by the panel, I think it was just really nice, for example, to see how people addressed the unknowns in our practice. And you know, I think we're all in an evolving situation. You know, do you use durvalumab in stage 3 cancer for EGFR and ALK when you either don't have data or you have data that suggests it may not be quite as effective? Some of the panel said yes, some of the panel said no. It turns out that when we have kind of statistical non-significance, we can see the difference between sort of pessimists that says we don't have any data that actually works versus optimists that say we don't have any data that doesn't work. And that's the beauty of medicine.
Thank you, Dr. Kamage, and thank you for listening to our third episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back regularly for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. And check out onclive.com/stateofthesciencesummit to sign up for a meeting coming to a city near you. Onc Live is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. That's all for today. Thank you for listening to OncLive On Air.